back. You are all welcome. Again, we still have the crisis of the Mariana in Kamalang, which is just one of the many tragic experiences that we have. There is the unresolved industrial action in Sibanye, and now the subsequently information that we received again that Sibanye is intending to lay off or by section 189 reduce its workforce by 6,000 employees. That's just one of the challenges that we have. One of the second most popular events of Parliament, but one of the days where the pensioners are looking forward to, which is the budget speech. I said I don't wish to be in the shoes of that Minister of Finance, but I'm sure all of us are looking forward to see what the budget says. My own worry is one that sometimes when we talk of budget, there seems to be more interest on where and what to spend, not on how to generate and make it a point that the next budget that is coming is much more better based on investment on generation of epic revenue. I always say what will be presented today is what could be. By nature, I'm sure the sector where we are and other, don't worry, Honorable. This is the end of the fifth parliament. So you can sit here. You may never know. Probably after May, you might be representing somebody else. So I wouldn't know what Mr. Piccinini is doing. So that's it. I won't ask you. Okay, so I'm saying it's just going to be one of the challenges or challenging periods. But having said so, we have only one item that we'll be dealing with. But before that, any apologies?
Good morning, everyone. I've got a project from Bot Mandela. He is having a project.
Okay. Honorable Lerima, must I say what you said informally, formally?
Which
or you
part?
Want to say it?
Which part? About meeting the.
Yes.
You may say it.
Honorable Lerima, the one-on-one caucus with me, requesting that you would love to be released the latest by 10:30. So I'm just saying it for the sake of the record. Okay, honorable members, we have invited the Human Rights Commission, having also dealt with the issue of the high-level panel presentation, and we then have to then get their presentation with regards to their observations and recommendations on the work that they have done in the industry. So, without any further delays, I assume, please bear with me, whereas when you are dealing with the human rights, I must be human rightly. I assume it's being led by Babu Sibanyo, so that you don't say, I don't recognize or appreciate human rights as human rights too. So I don't want to assume that you came in, that should be feeling bad for you. But let's deal with you, Mr. Sibanyo. You can introduce your team.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody around the table. My name is Jonas Ben J.B. Sibanyo, and I'm the commissioner at the South African Human Rights Commission, one of the 8 commissioners. I'm here today with Alex Fritz Gerald, senior legal officer, as well as Fadna Adams, our parliamentary legal officer. First of all, I have to just say we apologize for the slight delay. It's because of our senior legal officer who was only this morning because of the traffic jam and the rush hour here in the town. And we are meeting here today, presidentially, and we're talking about the day when the finance minister is going to deliver the, his maiden budget or speech. We are meeting on the Wednesday, the 20th of February. That was decided by the UN General Assembly on the 26th November 2007. And it started in 2009 until now. Every year, 20th of February is the World Day of Social Justice. And the theme for this year is, if you want peace and development, work for social justice. We are presenting you today the national hearing on the underlying socio-economic challenges of mining-affected communities in South Africa. Those communities in South Africa, here, they suffer challenges that other communities in other countries, overseas and abroad, do not experience. Yes. You will hear from the presentation of the report by Alex, and our report consists of recommendations and directives. Those directives, as the Human Rights Commission we are saying, are binding. But I will don't want to steal the thunder from the report from Alex. I will without any waste of time ask Alex to start with the presentation. Thank you very much. We also thank those nine functions which responded to our mining report that we submitted. But Alex will be with you. Thank you very much.
Much and apologies for my lateness. I assume that if I flew in on the earliest flight this morning, I would be able to get here on time, but lesson has certainly been learned. Thank you for bearing with me. Good morning to the chairperson and committee member Morgan. Thank you so much for having the commission here. I'm just going to try and speak relatively quickly to the presentation. It's somewhat long, but the report itself is nearly 100 odd pages. It's full of very dense information, so it's not a sort of document that really lends itself to presentation of this nature that well, but we've done it a few times, so I'm hoping that I'll be able to contextualize the slides as we go along. So just as a general proposition in terms of our report, it does generally just serve to corroborate and then also amplify concerns and issues that have been raised by civil society stakeholders and mining affected communities in South Africa over a number of years. The recommendations we believe as a commission are very much rooted in the existing legal framework, and we think that they flow directly from that framework. That's not to suggest that that framework is clear. Obviously, you probably know better than I, you know, how complex the existing legal framework is that regulates mining. The report in the general proposition finds that there's widespread non-compliance by both mining companies and the authorities that are tasked to monitor and oversee their operations. One of the issues is, that we've sort of found is that there is still an uncertainty about the division of responsibilities between the various relevant departments. I'm going to speak more in detail about the One Environmental System later on, but the purpose of it is to ensure an integrated approach to environmental management, monitoring and enforcement in respect to mining activities between DIA, DMR, and DWS as the primary obligation holders in terms of that system. However, the report indicates that there's a historic tendency of the relevant departments to work in silos and a failure to adhere to the principles of cooperative governance as set out in Section 40 and 41 of the Constitution. And that's why you'll see in the Commission's report that so many of our recommendations are joint recommendations, because we actually want to specifically encourage the relevant departments to work together in order to close the gaps that we're seeing and finding, and also to maximize the resources that we have in the state as well, and the experience that we have in the state. So that's why we do have so many joint recommendations, if you are wondering about that. So I'm just going to go ahead and launch into the presentation. So the report itself, I've split up the presentation in the same way. The first topic of the report is land and land use management. So the issue that we find here in terms of land use management is that as the slide intimates, that there's a gap in the mining application process where mining companies and the DMR and the Department of Rural Development appear to systematically be disregarding key pieces of legislation. So the first one that I wanted to speak a little bit about is on there is EPILRA. So in terms of EPILRA, people can't be just deprived of informal land rights unless they consent. So EPILRA applies to specific groups of people. It includes people who are living on communal land, people living on trust land, people who previously had permission to occupy, and anyone living on a piece of land uninterrupted since 1997, as if they were the owner. So whereas the MPRDA only requires consultation, that would be prior to the granting of the mining rights. In circumstances where EPILRA applies, mere consultation is not sufficient. You actually have to get the consent of the community. So we're not seeing that that has actually been implemented in all contexts in which EPILRA is applicable. Another piece of legislation which was mentioned on the slide, I'm never sure how to pronounce it. I call it SPUMA, but perhaps that's not right. But the basic premise of that legislation is that all land development applications have to be submitted to the relevant local municipality as the authority of first instance. So what we actually found from the submissions that we received during the hearing is actually half the time, sorry, that's a bit inappropriate, but in many instances, municipalities aren't even aware that mining rights have been granted in their municipalities. And basically, that leads to a massive chain of events, which I'll also discuss a little bit later. But it means that municipalities are not consulted, and they're unable to adequately plan and prepare for the influx of people who are going to be joining them through migrant labor. And they're basically not able to sort of develop their IDPs, and it sort of interrupts and puts extra additional burdens and pressures on the existing infrastructure within the municipality. So it leads to a lot of problems, and we'll pick that strain up again when we talk about the housing issue, because that's an area which is particularly affected by the lack of consultation with the local municipalities. Then the third issue that we picked up in this is that many of the participants of the hearing submitted that there's a distinct bias towards mining in terms of land use. So when a piece of land was used for something, and it might be agriculture, tourism, or mining participants saw that they perceive that there's a distinct bias towards mining as a form of development and investment over and above other different types of uses of land. Specifically, there were complaints about the use of land for mining, where it was, also prime agricultural land. In areas like Mpumalanga, this was a massive concern because of, you know, our own requirements as a country as well for, to guarantee food security and make sure that we are protecting our agricultural land as well. Also, Fumla also requires that special consideration is given to the protection of agricultural land, so that's also important as well. There's also an issue is that if there's a land use bias towards mining, what you get is that local economies become completely dependent on mining, and if there's a downturn in that economy or a mine closes or anything happens, what you have is that entire local economy is completely dependent on mining. It's not diversified. And it doesn't sort of sustain itself to develop economic opportunities beyond mining. So that's also one of the concerns that was raised at the commission. So moving on to the second area of land that we looked at as well. So the first was land use management. The second is mining and sensitive and protected areas. On the slide, you'll see the recommendations that we've made in respect of our findings there, but I'll speak to you a little bit about the findings that we made. So the commission is concerned that insufficient legal protection is being granted to strategic or sensitive environmental areas. So there is legislative and policy recognition of these protected areas, but yet mining rights still continue to be granted in them. And what happens then is that often there has to be a court case. So we saw that happen when there were mining rights granted in the Barberton Mining Nature Reserve, and also in the Mobola region in Mpumalanga, which is a protected area. So despite the recognition, legislative and policy-wise, that we're seeing, that doesn't seem to be impeding the granting of mining rights in those areas, which is a concern for us. The Commission is of the view that mining licenses should only be granted in sensitive and protected areas under highly restrictive conditions and following extensive public consultation. We also find that there's a need to immediately give effect to the internationally recognized precautionary principle. There are a number of international principles, I'll allude to some of them as well as we go forward, but internationally recognized and accepted principles that typically apply to mining operations in the rest of the world, which are not followed closely in South Africa. Precautionary principle is one of them, basically alludes to the idea that if there is going to be long-term unpredictable environmental damage to an area which needs to be protected because of some other aspect like its environmental biodiversity, then you should take the precaution and not pursue the mining right, especially for areas that are crucial to sustaining ecological biodiversity. One of the other issues that we found at the during the hearing was that the Commission was quite concerned about DMR's inability to provide a lot of information about the monitoring of mining activities in protected areas. So where the rights have already been granted and mining activities are happening, when we requested sort of substantive and detailed comprehensive information from DMR, they did express that they were concerned about non-compliance but weren't actually able provide a lot of detailed information to the Commission. So we actually didn't have a lot of information to work with to make a determination on, you know, what has been happening historically where money has already been granted. So that was a massive concern for us as well. So I'm going to move on to the next sort of subcategory of land, and this is dealing with rehabilitation and closure. This slide is to do with current and future closures. So not the historic legacy of abandoned, unrehabilitated, derelict and ownerless mines. We'll get to that, but just to deal with the sort of the current system as it's in place. So these are the recommendations that we have. They basically allude to the fact that we want the content guidelines for EIAs and EMPs to include comprehensive information on the quality of land and sustainable options for potential post-closure land use and the development of a national closure strategy. And where that sort of comes from is that even, so besides the legacy of abandoned mines and improper closure of mines, we're still seeing sort of a continuation of similar trends where mice are not being properly cloaked. So we found that it's unacceptable that, well, actually, let me start with DMR. So DMR, we found that had not taken adequate steps to secure financial provision for rehabilitating damage to the environment and water resources. All EIAs and EMPs need to clearly detail land quality and potential post-closure land use. So it should be clear from the commencement of the mining operations what condition the land will be restored to, so right from the beginning. And in that regard, on the mining company side, we also found it's unacceptable for them to not be providing that information. They need to provide detailed and sufficient information to enable communities and also local governments and municipalities to clearly understand how the land can be used post-closure. There is also an immediate need for legislative provisioning for standardized and realistic closure costing, concurrent rehabilitation, partial closure, as well as the establishment possibly of a trust account to cater for rehabilitation-related liabilities. Our view basically as a commission is that licenses, mining licenses, should not be granted in circumstances where long-term sustainable land use cannot be guaranteed. So if the land is going to be degraded to a point where that land is no longer of use to anyone for anyone for any purpose, then that needs to be a consideration at the beginning when the mining license. So I'm going to go on to the next slide. It continues with recommendations and then also goes on to address some of the legacy issues as well. You'll see that the recommendations deal with gaps relating to partial and full mine closures, partial closure, concurrent closure, aspects, concepts like that are different ways in which mines can start the process of rehabilitation even before mining operations cease. And in the long term, that limits the amount of damage, it limits the cost of rehabilitation, et cetera. So these are the types of things that we're recommending as the commission. In terms of regional and national closure strategies, DMR had advised us that some were developed in 2011 through the Council for Geosciences, but they were never implemented as a result of a possible conflict with the One Environmental System. And this was quite a while ago when the hearings were actually held, so just to put that into that context. And that in the process of conducting studies for a national closure strategy, I think that's somewhat closer now. One continuing outstanding legislative gap that we're still seeing is that the MPRDA and the Companies Act and the insolvency laws don't speak to each other. So in the event of a provisional winding up or liquidation of a mining company, the financial provision that is supposed to be put aside for rehabilitation of the land, rehabilitation of the site, it's not recognized as a special claim against the company's assets to be set aside before satisfying other creditors. So when it's liquidated, the preeminent creditor will make the claim, and basically what that means is that there won't be any money left over necessarily for rehabilitation, which means that that cost is essentially transferred to the state and to the mining affected communities living in close proximity because the site remains unrehabilitated. And we need to find a way to amend the legislation so that that gap can be closed. So I'm going to move on to the second topic, which is housing. I've alluded to it a little bit before already, but as per the slide, the responsibility for monitoring the implementation of housing obligations within the mining industry currently actually rests with the DMR. So there are a number of sort of failures or shortcomings which are happening in this context. One is that the mining companies are not adequately addressing anticipated levels of migration and population growth during mining license applications. So they're not saying our mine is likely to attract 8,000 people from outside of this community or outside of this area, and we've spoken to the municipality and we've made adequate housing, you know, provision for these people so that they can be accommodated with dignity in a dignified manner and have access to basic infrastructure and housing-related infrastructure. What we're seeing is that it's not being addressed in the mining application, they're failing to anticipate it, they're not including local government and municipalities in the planning phases, and it's also not being reflected in the social and labor plans, the SLPs. Also, it doesn't seem that on the other side that DMR is taking this information into account when it's granting the mining license. So our recommendation is obviously that DMR look at that and make sure that the mining company has made provision for adequate accommodation and housing for the migrant labor community that is going to be attracted to that area. It can't be that mining companies and DMR don't take cognizance of the way that they are changing the communities in which they operate in the communities which are in close proximity to the mines. So this all contributes to sort of an adequate planning. There's an adequate budgeting for housing at the local level. As a result, your housing and related infrastructure, including your water, your sanitation, your electricity, roads, that all becomes compromised. The effect of that, or the upshot of that, is that that could technically be interpreted as an interference with an existing right, which is unconstitutional, the constitutional right to housing. Because if you are a community that has constitutional right to housing and you have certain access to certain basic services, and a company comes in and brings with it and attracts, you know, and that triples or quadruples the size of your community, that infrastructure can no longer cope with the amount of people that are present in your community and the quality of the service that you receive is being degraded. And if you're quite out of the housing market that was there previously, et cetera, what happens is that your existing rights to basic services and your existing rights to housing has been compromised and interfered with. So that's something that's of massive concern to the commission. We've laid a lot of emphasis on that as well. So where a failure to integrate housing-related planning interferes with existing access to adequate housing, this constitutes a violation of the negative duty imposed by Section 8 of all persons, including mining companies, refrain from impeding existing access to adequate housing. So just going to the second slide, continuation of the recommendations that we've made there. We're asking DMR to reject mining license applications which fail to adequately address potential housing and accommodation issues that may arise as a result of mining projects. We also want to see proof of adequate consultation with local governments, and this brings in again how critical it is for mining companies to consult with municipalities at the local level so that there is coordination preparation for the mining companies, not merely just the operations of the mining companies, but those operations have impact on surrounding communities that reverberate through, and those consequences also need to be taken into account. It can't merely just be to look very narrowly at the operation solely. We have to take a broader approach about the broader community that is affected. So going on to, I think this is the third topic, which is the environment. There's a few subtopics that as a general proposition of where you sort of want environmental support comes in. And we accept that, and we don't seek to interfere with that as a commission. but our finding nonetheless, based on the submissions that were made at the hearing, is that that division of roles and responsibilities is not appropriate. So I'm just going to go on to the next slide. So this is also under environment, to do with air quality and blasting. There's an issue that emerged during the hearing process, which was that there's an uncertainty about whether the Air Quality Act applies to mining activities. Some mining companies believe it does, others don't believe it does. Some are complying, some are not complying. There's just different clarity. We've made a recommendation that we would like the DMR to work together to give us that clarity so we know what standards the mining companies are supposed to be holding themselves to in relation to air quality, and also so we can appraise ourselves of whether we believe that those are actually sufficient standards. Also, the dust control regulations, they came into effect in 2013, but they're not fully operational. Mining companies don't seem to be aware of them or their regulations. There certainly isn't compliance there. So that's also just an area that there's too much uncertainty in the areas that are supposed to relate to air quality. In relation to blasting, it's something that's an issue that was alluded to at the hearing repeatedly. Communities seem to really be suffering as a result of blasting operations, and it's something that came up quite a lot. There were multiple complaints raised about blasting operations conducted by mining companies, there's concerns about safety, claims of damage to properties and housing and other infrastructure, increased levels of dust, noise pollution, sufficient notice, and just general destruction of the community. So we found that there's an immediate need for DMR as a competent authority to take urgent action to address this gap. Just continuing that on the next slide. Those are our recommendations in respect of both air quality and that to give certainty about the Air Quality Act, does it apply to mining activities or not? Do we take measures to improve the control of air pollution impacts between DMR and develop blasting regulations so that there is a standardized procedure and practice across the entire industry? Just so that we can preserve the health and well-being of our mining affected communities. Okay, the next section is on social and labor plans. I've just put the recommendations of the commission up on the slide. As you know, social and labor plans are a core legal requirement for the granting of a mining license. They have to be submitted to and approved by DMR. These obligations are not discretionary, non-compliant breaches of the actual legal mining license itself. The SLPs, what we found with them is that not only is there a massive variation across mining companies about the content of SLPs and also their quality, but also they don't actually seem to, there doesn't seem to be a system in place being properly implemented which is holding them accountable to their SLPs that they've said that they will do. So DMR has developed SLP guidelines, but they're not legally binding, so it's just a guide. It's just an advisory, essentially. So companies are pretty much free to put in the content that they wish, so, and that leads to the divergence. So the current SLP system in our findings does not adequately address the negative impacts of mining activities and the shortcomings in the design of and compliance with SLP commitments. This is all limiting the ability of mining companies and their operations to actually drive socioeconomic transformation in mining-affected communities. As a general proposition, the hearings disclosed that the benefits of mining are not accruing to local communities. We've seen very little evidence of that. The SLPs are literally in place as a mechanism in order to mitigate that and share the benefits of mining and the resources of South Africa. That is not currently happening on the basis of the submissions that we received at the Commission. So we've advised that the process of developing SLPs be consultative and should respond to inputs from the communities and local government regarding required socioeconomic outcomes as well. So this is obviously quite a contentious issue, so I'm going to just go on and talk a little bit more about it. These are continuing just the recommendations that we made in respect of SLPs. there's an urgent need for the DMR to develop clear and binding requirements for the contents of SOPs and ensure that they are aligned to EIAs and EMPs and include environmental information on the impacts of mining and post-closure land quality. So you'll see that like it's, everything is sort of coherent, which is why it's so important to read the mining report in context, but everything sort of comes together. So when we talk about post-closure, we want to see those undertakings then in the SLP. So we're trying to bring in all the gaps into and reflect them in different ways of where they should be reported to, so that the DMR can assess compliance, and so then we in turn can assess whether the DMR is monitoring and evaluating as well. So we also found that DMR must enforce compliance with SLP obligations and develop meaningful sanctions for companies that fail to comply with their SLP commitments. So that would mean revoking mining licenses. That would mean financial penalties for non-compliance, various penalties that are actively implemented but are also severe enough to dissuade that behavior so that we see that there is compliance and follow through. We also ask that DMR should define the minimum amount of financial contribution towards SLP projects, and this amount should be ring-fenced. So I'm going to go on to the next section, and that is meaningful participation, consultation, and consent. There's a lot of different themes in here that I'm going to try and elucidate them. So the first one that I'm going to allude to is the consent issue. So I've indicated that there's other pieces of legislation that do require consent, for example, in PILRA, which also sometimes apply. But I think even as a general proposition, and I had alluded earlier to internationally recognized principles which are being implemented in other countries outside of South Africa. One of them, of course, is free, prior, informed consent. Our consultation, our required and legislatively mandated consultations in terms of NPRDA, consultation implies consensus but doesn't actually require consent of communities that are affected by mining. And I think that increasingly you're seeing, even in the court decisions and as we go forward, that is becoming increasingly unacceptable. Consent is becoming increasingly required. And I know that, I think that the Minister publicly recently said, if we have to get consent, we can't mine. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of countries who do make it work. It's not something that we're saying it isn't the law. NPRDA does not currently require consent, but the sort of global consensus is certainly moving towards consent. From a legal perspective, from a sort of, you know, broader sort of business and human rights perspective, that those are the trends, and I think that the stakeholders do need to start getting to grips with that concept and how they're going to start implementing it. The sort of any judgment, and there's a wide range of other judgments as well, which are all indicating and pointing to the same thing, which it seems there's an increased appetite and expectation of consent as well. So that's just sort of as an aside of processes and trends which have been happening since we conducted our hearings on the mining report. In any event, the NPRDA requires extensive consultation to take place, and DMR does have and has produced guidelines for consultation, but again, these are not legally binding. So the content and form of consultation varies widely, its adequacy varies widely. There isn't also a document that we can say, you know, this was the standard of consent and you didn't meet it. So it's very difficult to hold mining companies accountable to say your consultation fell short, because there is no standard to which to hold them to, which is a problem for us. So just to go on to the next slide, continuing in the same theme here. These are our recommendations and directives in reaction to our findings in the same area. We found that there's a compelling need to develop clear consensus-driven standards for compliance, evaluation, the assertion of the duty to achieve meaningful participation from the commencement of mining operations. Meaningful participation must be both through process and outcome. It needs to seek to legitimize the process and ensure that needs are understood and addressed as between all the stakeholders. It needs to be accessible, open, representative, inclusive. You know, there's a tendency for it to appear to be reduced to a tick box exercise at some point, but also there's countrywide and global implications of mining as well, with pollution and climate disruption. So we've also asked that the relevant stakeholders consider, you know, what is required for consultation as well more broadly, and whether there's opportunity for wider public participation when granting mining licenses, particularly given that the effects of pollution obviously affect proximate communities first, primarily and disproportionately, but also cannot be contained and have a tendency to affect other people and persons, such as the acid mining and the legacy of abandoned mines. Then, obviously, as a critical sort of premise and ingredient for meaningful participation is the access to information, transparency issue. So there isn't, it's not possible to have meaningful engagement if one party does not have access to information which is necessary to make those engagements meaningful. So we've developed a number of recommendations here. Generally and broadly, you know, we found that there's still a tendency to secrecy within the mining industry. There is certainly an overuse, it seems to us, from the submissions of the term confidentiality. Mining companies declare that various documents are confidential and in opposition to the requirements of PAYA and our constitution and et cetera, they say that they contain commercial information, but that is information that communities need to participate in mining and for also civil society and Chapter 9 institutions like ourselves to be able to assess whether they are doing what they're supposed to be doing. So the provision of information raised frequently during the hearings, consultations, it was reported with the communities frequently, you know, emphasized the potential benefits of mining, but failed to actually articulate the risks and the costs of the mining. So also that sort of disproportionate information access as well. The information is often provided to communities only in English. It includes a lot of technical, scientific, and legal language. They don't use plain language. They don't use languages which are accessible or prominent in the particular communities which are affected. And in the absence of binding sort of regulations about what consultation entails, that will probably continue to be the case. And for us as a commission, it really calls into question about whether that kind of consultation can actually be meaningful. Further, access to information is beyond just something that we want to happen in the mining community. It's a fundamental right of the commission as guardian of the constitution. It's an opportunity for public scrutiny and enhanced accountability, which is sort of what is missing at the moment, in our view, in the mining community. So there's a number of documents that DMR, DEA, DWS have identified, including SLPs, environmental authorizations, water use licenses, compliance reports, environmental licenses, as being automatically available to the public, automatically public documents. But despite the classification of SLPs as being automatically publicly available, the DMR has conceded to us that their officials still remain reluctant to release them themselves because of the fear of legal action from the mining companies. I think that DMR has indicated to us that they want the mining companies to publish their SLPs themselves on their website, which we're very happy with, but obviously that will have to be monitored to make sure that it does actually happen, so that those things that are publicly available, as PAYA says, that they are automatically supposed to do. So, and then the last slide just speaks specifically to the PAYA issue. So DMR has its own PAYA manual. That's where SLPs are listed as automatically publicly available. And where there isn't compliance by mining companies, we've suggested that DMR engage the information regulator. or to help enforce compliance with PIA, where they haven't been. The basic principle that we sort of want to get to is that disclosure of information is the rule and non-disclosure is the exception, whereas it seems to be the other way around currently. The right is being inconsistently observed, and we really do think that in relation to mining, there's a duty to proactively release information and proactively make it publicly available and accessible. There needs to be a clear criteria for the classification of information of certain mining-related information as confidential, because we think that that is used quite freely. It's a problem for us that, you know, information is not made available in certain language and in certain formats, which make it accessible. Besides even the language issue for people with disabilities, it's basically completely inaccessible, which is also an issue. And then just to get on to, so I said in the beginning that we found that our recommendations are rooted in and flow from the existing legal framework. The issue, you know, that sort of emerged from the hearing is that there isn't sort of a consistent implementation of that legal framework, and I think that's why this was such a big theme for us, so compliance, monitoring, and enforcement. There's definitely an urgent need for the DMR to address its own internal capacity constraints so that it can effectively ensure that the mining application process complies with all the relevant laws and policies across all spheres and departments of government. It needs to have enough inspectors, it needs to have enough internal capacity to evaluate SLPs. The one environmental system that has been sort of implemented and put into place has put that responsibility on DMR. And so although we are very aware of and empathetic to the capacity constraints, that was the design of the legislative system and the framework. And so the state has to provide the resources necessary for its implementation. So if DMR is going to oversee and monitor compliance, it needs to have the capacity to monitor compliance. And that is not negotiable. So there's also a significant delay in obtaining approval that was reported by mining companies, that was reported by other state departments, by municipalities, where they just can't get the approval for projects timely. Often with we're seeing projects going ahead even without certain approvals being granted. And certain dots being, crossed. Also, those delays in approval also cause further delays later down the line when it comes to compliance and monitoring and enforcement processes. So we just really want to see, as the Commission, the DMR, play an active role in facilitating the intergovernmental cooperation on mining-related matters and ensuring responsiveness and cooperation by mining companies. Also, this was another aspect where during the hearing, the Commission was very concerned that DMR wasn't actually able to provide a lot of substantive or detailed information about the rates of compliance with the regulatory obligations in the mining sector. So they expressed their concerns with non-compliance. They agreed that they do think there is widespread non-compliance, but they were also unable to give us specific information in that regard, and then for us, that's obviously a massive concern. Second to last slide, folks. Thank you for bearing with me. So this is also sort of just the last part about compliance monitoring and enforcement. It speaks more to the sanctions that I've already alluded to. You know, obviously, when there are capacity issues with enforcement and compliance, then perhaps it's better to implement a sanction or penalty system, which is really off-putting and will encourage compliance. So we've included some suggestions there from the Commission. We've also asked that the DMR work with the industry bodies, work with the Chamber of Mines, encourage self-monitoring and independent monitoring as well, to ensure that there's compliance with the applicable laws and policies. As a general proposition, we found that the existing sanctions for non-compliance with environmental laws and regulations are inadequate, and they do not address nor disincentivize systemic non-compliance in the sector, nor are they consistently or comprehensively implemented. So that was just a very quick sort of wrap up of the report and the recommendations that we made. It's certainly not dispositive. There's still a lot that I left out in the interest of time and efficiency. In terms of the way forward, we are closely monitoring the implementation of the recommendations through the Office of Commissioner Sabignoni under the auspices of what we refer to as the Section 11 Committee. It's a committee established by the Commission for a specific purpose. This one is established for the sole purpose of monitoring the implementation of recommendations of this report. It's a committee made up of various experts, independent experts, who assist the Commission to do that monitoring. So I think that we've had now just recently the second meeting of that committee, and DMR were in attendance and presented to us. We've had multiple engagements with DMR. We're very pleased by their engagement with us. They've been incredibly proactive. And it's really, I think, for us as a commission, I think that we found it to be very refreshing, and we're very happy, and we look forward to working with them closely in future. From the commission's perspective, the recommendations that we've made are broad, they are far-reaching, they are systemic, and we are trying to be as sort of pragmatic in the process of monitoring the implementation as possible as well going forward. The DPME has been very helpful to us as well in coordinating efforts, consultative engagements with various departments. DEA was also before us at the same Section 11 committee meeting. DWS has not been as forthcoming, but we are going to take steps to engage with them further. The Interministerial Committee have been very helpful. So we have various timelines of when certain recommendations have to be complied with by. You know, unfortunately, we do still have some considerable non-compliance. Some of the reports we've received thus far are not at the standard that we would have expected, but I think also we are also working with the departments to convey to them exactly what we expect from them and what information we want from them, and that is also going to be a process of learning as well. But certainly, so far, we've been very grateful to the relevant stakeholders, the most relevant stakeholders, the DMR, for their assistance and helping us thus far. Thank you so much.
Thank you. There is our report. I don't want to disclose my age. In the past, we used to end in writing a letter and saying, Amate as now, Montenegro. It is a detailed report, but we have tried to condense it. Only to explain that my focus area at the Human Rights Commission is called land, farming communities, and environment. And then we also have our Section 11 committee in terms of our South African Human Rights Act number 40 of 2013 that is working with us in monitoring this issue of the right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Welcome, Honorable Matlana. And I appreciate that once you came in the middle of the conversation, you already your hands are well done with your old man's intelligence. It's old.
No,
Okay, the honorable members, there is the report, presentation. You know, the problem is that there is something called separation of power. Sometimes separation of power is but a very silent element, contestation of power, very silent. I heard when the commissioner was reporting here, he said some of those are just mere findings, and some of those are recommendations, and therefore they are binding. So I remember that this issue of binding and so forth is a matter of the courts that has been determined. So I'm not sure how far we could go, but just note that there are recommendations which are enforceable. But I won't limit you. Honorable Matlala, Commissioner, we've got a system that you just take those questions. But at my discretion, if they bombard you with many, I stop them and give you time to breathe. Honorable Matlala, Honorable Schmidt, Honorable Rishma, Honorable Mafolo, Honorable Jaff. If Matlala is going to take 5 minutes, we may be compelled that we then allow you to attend to him because he has taken 5 minutes. Okay, Matlala.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, the Commission, the Department, and my colleagues too. Yeah, I can't forget you.
Hold on a bit, Honorable Matlala.
Sure, thank you.
At least I always say you don't have to be dismissed just to for failure to apologize. First, let me apologize. The committee assistant is not around, so we are getting some assistance. So when you came in, so it's going to be my request. When you came in, there was no tea, there was nothing.
Oh, yes.
Now, it has just arrived. Can I request, honorable members, that by installment, someone said, not all of you en masse, just stand up one, grab a cup of coffee and whatever, come back, feed the other one will follow, but very quietly. At least we are not a mass meeting. Please accept my apology. I should have announced at that stage because we usually start with that when we are waiting for those who might come a bit late. Okay, continue, Honorable Matlala.
Thank you, Chair. My apology to you, the Chair of the Committee. I've said my apology that I will join the committee meeting 20-30 minutes. So unfortunately I'm not quite sure as to whether I did present my apology to the committee. So as I was getting in, Chair, the commissioner was still at the first two pages. So I am going to ask questions on the slide where she was presenting. I was in the meeting. The slide, Chair, is on housing. On housing, which is very important for us and the department. Chair, I want to check or get the clarity from the commissioner with regards to housing as to whether is the department compelled to provide housing for mine workers who reside or who are members of the community, where the operations of the mine is taking place. The other one, Chair, relates to the illegal miners. The illegal miners, I'm not sure, because also the illegal miners, they are miners, but they are illegal. But in future, don't foresee that you might have a problem. You might be approached by these illegal miners to your commission to say, we are human beings too. We want the department to provide us with housing. Is the department compelled also to build or to provide housing for illegal miners, irrespective of where they are coming from? Can I get a clarity, Chair, from the Commission? Thank you very much. Smith?
I feel there's only one thing that is good, Honorable Masala, is that you are saying those who embark on criminal activity can go and say, you are conducting a criminal act, but can you give us housing? Okay. I hear your question. Continue, Honorable Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Mr. Sabanyoni would know, when we were still in the JAC, the most basic questions such as separation of powers seem to trip up the most informed and experienced lawyers. So everything is not as easy as it seems, and that's basically what I want to stay startled with this report, because the first question I have is the legal enforceability of your distinction between recommendations and directives, because they are clearly a distinction, and how enforceable are they? Secondly, timelines. You refer to timelines. I take it there in the report. I haven't seen your, I haven't read your report, but I guess it would be included there. Or am I wrong? I don't know. The third issue is more of a statement slash question. Our third separation of powers. Now, in the whole mining cycle, mining application cycle, there are various departments, various stakeholders. It's not just the mining company. It's local government, as we just said, provincial government, national government. Within national government, you've got DMR, you've got DEA, you've got Department of Water Affairs, and whatever they call from there. Now, I'm not sure whether you are making this presentation to the Minerals Committee, and therefore the slant is on the minerals side and the responsibility of the mining companies. Therefore, I preface my remarks by saying there should be an equal obligation on every other department involved and or who should be involved. Because the application is one process. And in the event we have a small town where it is to be overrun by three times the size of its current population, there is a duty on provincial government and national government to ensure that whatever investment is made in that little town, going to a bigger town, is met with the same standards of compliance and requirements to ensure that that infrastructure, the housing, the schools, and whatever goes with it, is also established. So it's a combined effect. It's not, let's put it more positive, this government wants mining investment wherever it can find it. It has a concomitant obligation to make sure that whatever investment is received, that concomitant services are met. It can't be an alternative. And the reason why it is as it is at the moment is predominantly, I would say, the failure of government to ensure that the services that, such as schooling, infrastructure, the basic communities are not met. It expects of the mining company to fulfill all those roles and then creates an expectation on communities. Unreasonable expectations on the community because they haven't seen any SLPs. So the best thing that can take place is that there's some form of accountability, not only towards the mining community, but also towards government, so that they realize that the Department of Mineral Resources issues a license.
that these are the requirements set from the mining company, but there are also requirements to be met by government, local, provincial and national. So it is excellent. It's an excellent move to have this SRP made available to the public. The second point, the question basically arises from that, is which other documents should and ought to be, in your view, be made available? I know there's a, you can argue that there's corporate sensitivity to certain, I'm not saying you should make available your financial statements, I'm not saying at all. But in, you know, as you have SRPs, you have other documents, are there any other documents in your report that you say ought to be or should be made available in order to ensure that there's a reality or a reality check in terms of the expectation created whenever there's ambition? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Honorable Lauren, accept my apology. I should have been fair on the last few days we are spending together. And started with you when I looked at the time. So please accept my apology that I didn't notice we were quite close to 10:30.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I do have a question, but I will rely on the minutes to find the answer. I've got a question, a suggestion, and a comment. But the question is, it's a very difficult one of how you define a mining community. Is it people who live on land which is directly going to be mined? Is it people who live 2 kilometers away, 5 kilometers away? Is it people who have a second residence in the area? Is it people who were born there and still have some sort of kinship? That's a pretty important question. Secondly, my suggestion is you seem to have taken the Chamber of Mines or Minerals Council, as it's called now, as the sole representative of mining. It's certainly the biggest and most important, but it's not the only one. And sometimes its requirements are different to those of the smaller miners, for instance. So, and I can think of, just off the top of my head, some of the junior miners who are in the alluvial diamond sector, where there's about 200 operations, probably about 5,000 people, but through a lot of different areas. It might be useful to talk to them. And finally, there's my comment, which is that mining companies have been tasked with compliance, and you can almost divide it into two sets of demands. And the one is expressed through the mining charter, and it's things like ownership, racial quotas and appointments, things basically contained in the mining charter. There's been a whole sort of second set of requirements, which are the ones largely that you're addressing. It's things like community consent, it's things like blasting regulations, it's things like integration with local government. And those have been just kind of added on but undefined, and yet a lot of them are very, very difficult and expensive to comply with. It's my view that the reason that we will not get more mining investment is because there's simply too much. I think the second set of requirements, the ones that you're talking about here, are the more important ones. They relate more directly to social license with mining communities, and those are the ones that we should prioritize. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, hold on, my follow-up come to you. Let me give you a chance to respond. If possible, accept my special request. We have always been a very good committee. I've got no intentions to make things go worse. If you can start with the statement or questions by Honorable Lorena, so that he is not saying when we captured minutes next time and say, no, but I don't think that's how the minutes work. At least that answer, you will be able, when we say we move the minutes, to say they are a true reflection of what the response was. If you can start with this.
Thank you so much for your questions. They're very insightful, and your suggestion. How do we define a mining community? I can't remember which definition we used exactly for the report, but we would have relied on a definition in terms of the existing legislative framework. I'm just not sure which one. But I will check that as well. We are in agreement. Chamber of Mines is not the sole voluntary association in the mining community. We do acknowledge that. So we do acknowledge that, and we will be engaging with the other voluntary associations as well in the course of this report. And so we've used sort of like language which is sort of says like other relevant stakeholders to try and capture them as well in terms of our recommendations. Mining companies being tasked with the second set. I think it's certainly a challenge. I mean, it's reassuring to hear that you think that they're more important. I think that as a general proposition, we're all sort of finding our way as expectations increase. We are living predominantly in sort of like a rights-based, it's a rights-based society, and globally we're increasingly rights-based as well. So that is sort of the line of progression of the law, and otherwise as it goes forward. I think that we certainly, and I think that's why it's so important for us to say that we think that these obligations that we're talking about and these recommendations flow directly from the existing framework, is that we don't believe that we're creating new obligations. We believe that we're amplifying and emphasizing existing obligations through this report. So a lot of, even our responses that we get from a lot of the state departments is like, yes, well, this, we've got a law for it. And we're like, oh, yes, we realize that there's a law. The problem is the implementation of the law has not been consistent thus far. You know, that I think that it's a massive debate around whether it's too expensive for mining companies, whether we're ending up with, you know, disincentivizing mining in South Africa, whether they're going to go to other places, whether it's a race to the bottom, how much can we compromise. Thankfully, because I represent the Human Rights Commission, I only need to be concerned about the rights aspect of it. So I'm much less empathetic about the challenges of the mining communities. But being a former corporate merchant acquisition lawyer myself, in my estimation, I think that's fine.
No, before Lorema calls, can I talk about directives and recommendations? I will be very brief, Honorable Lorema. And we are a Chapter 9 institution, state institution supporting constitutional democracy. And there are several Chapter 9 institutions. One of them is the Public Protector, Umzikelo Womphakathi. And as the Human Rights Commission, we are saying we are one of those state institutions supporting constitutional democracy that are tabulated in Chapter 9. And the Constitutional Court has made a finding to say the decisions of the Public Protector are binding. And as the Human Rights Commission, we are saying there would be no reason to say the decisions of the Human Rights Commission are not binding, while those of the Public Protector are binding. That is why our report is compiled in the sense that there are some issues which we regard as recommendations, but others we are specific, spot on. We are saying these are directives. And we are saying if we have made a directive and any line function has got a problem with, it is only a court of law that can say, can review that directive. So we are briefly here on that. We respect the separation of powers, but we wanted to be saying we are second to none to those functions of the Public Protector. Section number 183 give us power, and we want to use those powers where we are able to make directives, and so that we are called a watchdog. We are not a toothless dog, and a dog barks if a stranger approaches the house. But if the stranger ignores the barking, then the dog barks. Okay? Then no, there were other questions.
In regards to the question about housing, is the department compelled to provide housing to members of the community? No. So the department is responsible for monitoring the implementation of housing obligations within the mining industry. So they have to monitor. So their obligations are monitoring obligations. So if a mining company has undertaken to provide X number of housing in terms of their social and labor plan, then the DMR has to monitor that they've actually complied with that undertaking and that they actually do deliver X number of houses. So the DMR doesn't have any have any responsibility to provide housing to miners or illegal miners. In terms of the timelines, and the timelines are in the report. Also, I do have a document which is it's not a legal document. Sorry, I always have to make this disclaimer. A legal document, but it's a disaggregated document of all our recommendations and the timelines of those recommendations, which I'm happy to provide to IANDA for distribution to the committee if you would like to see that. Sure. And then the separation of powers issue, equal obligations at every department, yes, absolutely. The invitation from the portfolio committee asked us to focus on issues that deal with its oversight responsibilities on the DMR. So that's why we've limited our presentation to focus on DMR's singular sole and joint recommendations with other departments. And we've left out a lot of recommendations which are directed at other departments. But, you know, for their sins, obviously, we know most of the recommendations are directed at them. As the primary obligor in terms of the legal framework. What you said about the failure to ensure basic services, certainly, but as we go back to our recommendations, that's why we have this instance where the mining companies have to talk to the local government. So local government can't provide extra infrastructure and extra services where they're unaware that there is even going to be an influx or a migration labor community joining the existing community. So it starts with the transparency, the discussions, and so forth. So that's what we feel is the basic first step as well. Yeah. In terms of which other documents should be made publicly available, we are in agreement with DMR's list as in their PIA manual. So that is the environmental impact assessments, the environmental management programs, water use license authorizations, environmental authorizations. They have a list in their PIA manual, and we are in agreement that those are the documents that should be publicly available. I think that's
the question. Okay, Honorable Mafolo. You are not there. Honorable Mafolo, Honorable.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation made to us. Chairperson, my question will be on slide 7, but I'm happy that you have already answered the issue on time frame because that was very bothering me. Sometimes a mining company can comply adequately with those SLPs and housing, but immediately after they have granted a license, they don't comply at all. So monitoring and implementation is very important on this one. And also welcome the issue of, on slide 12, the issue of publication of SLPs, because the community must know what is going to happen in their land of place. But I think those ones who don't comply, so that at the end of the day, people are not blaming mining companies, they are blaming the Department of Mineral Resources. So it's very important people must know what's going to happen. If that doesn't going to happen in a short time, you must see action happening on that thing. Mine is just talking about those things. Thank you,
Chair. Honorable Jafta? No, thank you, Chair. No, only one question for me, Chair. And it revolves around the question of capacity with DMR, especially in implementing the the recommendations and also monitoring the very same recommendations by the commission. How do you see the capacity of the department, especially given the existing offices, that is only national and regional offices? Is all this report not implying that maybe the department must consider also extending its offices down to the local municipalities, specifically those that are having the operations or the mining activities taking place? Thank you, sir.
Okay. Any answer to this? You can, brother, you can.
Yeah, I can.
I think that meant that I'm supposed to answer this. Thank you so much for your comments on the report. We do certainly hope that making social media plans more available for more our communities. On the question of capacity of DMR and implementing the recommendations, I mean, I sound like a broken record, so apologies in advance, but our belief is that these are DMR's existing obligations in terms of the legal framework. We don't believe that we're adding additional obligations to DMR at the moment, even though I think it may feel like that, certainly. I don't think that we expect DMR to extend its offices to the local municipality. I think that one of the central themes out of this report is that the state departments and the relevant stakeholders can simply no longer work in silos. They have to work together. The management of this type of industry specifically requires that all the stakeholders are at the table and that they're working together to plan and to implement so that we can limit the effect on our environment, on our water resources, on our communities, and so that the business of mining is conducted in a responsible manner, and so that every South African can benefit from the resources that we have in South Africa. So I think that's the expectation that we have, and I think that it does mean that perhaps there will have to be sort of a change of some kind, but I think that what we've seen already from the engagements that we've had with DMR, they hosted us as a commission and said it was the Department of Health, the Department of Water and Sanitation, various departments, all of whom had recommendations directed towards them in terms of the report. And those kinds of engagements, I think, if they can become more frequent, more routine, and departments can start getting to know each other and the different technocrats can actually meet each other, I think that we could possibly and potentially be in for a much better regulated industry than the one that we currently have. So I think that, no, we don't expect DMR to extend itself to a local municipal level, and we are empathetic to the resource constraints and capacity constraints that it has, but we do expect it to engage with the relevant stakeholders when taking decisions.
With your permission, Chairperson, a small annual addition. Chairperson, last year we submitted the report in the IMC, the Interministerial Committee. And then in fairness, I should mention that the DMR is one of the nine functions that has been engaging with us as the Human Rights Commission to say, how do you expect us to respond to the recommendations in the directive? And as recently as last week, am I correct? As recently as last week, we had a meeting. So during that meeting, it cropped up to say, how do they cater for those far-flung areas, deep rural areas in the land? And then they responded during our engagement to say, they make ensure that even those communities that are staying in the far-flung areas, deep rural areas, are getting cut for. We talked about the things. I'm sorry.
Okay, we are already projected before we can start. know when things are happening and you want to meet your child and then somebody that comes in and gives you the good reason not to do what he intended to do. It's okay. Honorable Biginini, I thought I'd seen your hand up. Honorable Nyambi, I thought I'd seen your hand up. It's not you, I'm going this direction. Is your, are you thinking, or is your hand up, Honorable Yago?
My hand is up.
I'm closing after this. Okay, Honorable Biginini.
No, thank you. I'm not sure, I really thought that was going to be an introduction of this important human rights commission process. Mine is about the process, not you or my part of what. In my future, that I think is our first meeting. Now, I think it's our first meeting. Now, it started somewhere, this report, before it came here. Now, I thought the chair, when he opens the meeting, would take us through, you know. I mean, example, if you are saying normally, the background of this meeting might meet with the society forum, as you are saying, the society forum was very broad. Yeah, I mean, you might meet one of Kumala, you might meet me from Sube, or the national one, I'm not sure. No, I'm just, I don't want it to be really out of order, but it was me, the process man. You know, we just proceed as if everything was normal, the report consultation. The process started in 2012, I mean, example, that's where we are. Just, you know, now I was really a little bit happy with issues that are being talked about. They are quite important. You know, or when you talk about the legislative framework that you go through to it, you see the document, maybe you look through the document, you come with the report. I'm just raising this thing to say, I really, I'm the only one sure who was not up to part with each and everyone. Now I was really considering to say, I think this chair, our chair, your chair now, was not really fair to us now on this particular matter. You know, most of the game, I feel you to do in Buga, to a few parts. But I'm raising these issues to say it becomes very critical so that we are able to move together. You know, because all of us want to change the country, we want to put our part, but I think we need also to come together to say where do we assist each other. But I think that's where I'm ready a little bit. But my colleagues, I think they really understand what they just move with speed with you. I'm happy with that. But mine, I'm that old school, very young, but in old school, where I think it's important to say, with this kind of whatever, sometimes we short the ground and then we proceed. But I'm not going to take you back. If they are happy, I might be happy, then they might continue otherwise. Thank you very much.
Honorable Nyambi, just one thing, Honorable Tegenini. Being old school, then it means when the president was telling us about digital education,
what
is that? I said, I'm worried about the educators, whether themselves they are up to time to do that. So I'm worried now when the president speaks on behalf of Parliament to say probably those people collectively took that decision with the president themselves. They are digitally behind schedule. But I know what you say. So the old school, the problem with the old school, it may not be as old as the school is.
Yeah, not in my
question. Honorable Nyami.
Question, Chair. Just because we've got different types of mining industry in our country. What I wanted to know is that all of them, they must provide a complete in terms of housing for the community around where mining is done. And also, what is going to happen if the mining industry is going to occur in an area where there is an existing community, but it's a distance in terms of the kilometers or whatever. Thank you.
Are you done?
Yes, sir.
Another Buyako.
Thank you, Chair. I also welcome the report. It's quite comprehensive. And I think it gives hope that there is somebody looking after the communities as well and trying to make sure that DMR does perform the duties that they need to perform. My question is around the environmental, because Honorable Larima asked something that I wanted to ask, which is you say that you direct DMR to do a lot of things, but how much of the directing is then enforceable? So mine was this, in terms of the environmental and health effects of communities, you say that you also work with the Department of Health. How much cooperation do you also get from the Department of Health in terms of assisting communities that are affected health, in terms of their health and respiratory issues? How much are they committed to helping those communities receive health and awareness when they start to become sick?
Okay.
Thank you. In terms of the first question, apologies from our side. Simply just wanted to condense what is a very large report into the most salient features. The invitation indicated that the report had been referred to the committee by the speaker, so my assumption was that I wouldn't repeat certain sort of parts of it. Also, in terms of the process, even though that is detailed comprehensively in the report about how we actually conducted the process, neither Commissioner Sivignoni nor myself were actually employed by the commission at that time. So I don't have any first-hand knowledge of what happened at that point, but it is recorded within the report itself. In terms of the social neighbor plans, because the regulations which guide social neighbor plans don't have, like, they're just non-binding guidelines, I wouldn't have thought that there was a specific legal obligation to have housing. There isn't a legal document which dictates what has to be in an SLP. So I don't think all SLPs have to address and provide housing. But our recommendations are more in terms of directed at those that do address housing issues. And in terms of existing communities, we've seen a range of responses. I mean, sometimes the migrant community simply moves into the existing community. Sometimes they move closer to the mine. Sometimes a new community is established. There's a range of different outcomes in a scenario like that, depending on the communities themselves. In terms of how much support we get from the DOH, currently I'm not aware of DOH's work in that area. I definitely don't want to say that there isn't any, because there quite possibly may be. But there are recommendations, which I didn't discuss because of the focus on DMR, but there are recommendations within the report directing DOH specifically. I think one or two of them I alluded to, directing DOH specifically to do a public inquiry into sort of all the issues you alluded to, respiratory issues, etc.
I thought you wanted to fill up
I sense that you're about to close.
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
You must wait for me, I've not asked.
Okay. But I want to echo what our senior leader said, insofar as where we started with this presentation, and then also we're
conscious of time, and also I just want to emphasize the question of apologizing, because we said on our beginning we want to contain ourselves within the time allocated, but we are not disrespectful. Within the upper and last month, and I sense how you should treat people when you arrive there, because some of the questions were the Human Rights Commission was there in 2007. What about the now? What was happening in the middle until now? And while we are newly elected commissioners, I was here in Parliament in 2014. I had to apologize for Abu Tadej. And then thereafter, I had to commit ourselves to it. We would be working forward with them. I'm also staying with this community, I mean the committee. We will be engaging with the parliamentary committee, the portfolio committee, and also to emphasize clarity. We will also require you to hold the executive accountable. Because funds are personally, there's challenges out there. So it's our joint effort as a Human Rights Commission, ensuring that the rights are protected, the rights are promoted, the rights are monitored, and the right portfolio committee, we need your help. We need to join hands to take this forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Manager. Before I go to the department proper as well, there are issues, although you have already been protected. let me start from where Honorable is beginning his sentence, and probably accept also from our side that we never said go to a black lab. We specifically put a topic. Then, which you are responding to the topic given. Point one. Point two, I think let's acknowledge the fact that you tried to give a little bit. I think what Honorable was talking about is that, because generally sometimes the human rights or all the Chapter 9 institutions undertake a specific process, whether investigation or what, subject to complaint made. Like your public protector, 90% of what we'll be dealing with is someone who would have come and complained, and therefore that element is required. But I understand the context where you come. Look, before I go to the department, and I think let me also start by saying that it is the unheard of or unparliamentary to set up institutions of democracy and then at the end of the day negate or see them as opponents instead of as people who seek to extend the work that you are doing. Rest assured, the reason we invited you is simply because we have to understand some of the issues. And that work that is being done, it cannot be done and then it has got no basis to find expression in the process of implementation. So I'm just saying these are some of the things. But I think it may not be now, whatever, because I doubt we can do anything effectively that can be, we must be honest, also, that can be done between now and the 20th of March. Because 20th of March we'll be saying bye, two things for sure will happen. Some of us may not be back here. That is highly probably possible. But the second one is that even if we're here, we may not be the same committee. You see. So whatever we do now, we do it in order to pass the ball to those ones that are coming to play a new match completely. So when we do these things, we need to have work consolidated. there going forward. But I think it will be amiss, because my view is that it will be very difficult for the committee to try and exhaust this discussion. And please understand my sensitivity. Part of the problem sometimes is that, like you say, and I think I must appreciate that you are engaging with DMR, so that the complex nature, sometimes those recommendations may face, it may not be on the basis of the liking of the DMR or not. They will have to, and I think fortunately it's a human right, I must say, especially on other issues, like you said, specifically on land, maybe if we had met it at a good time, you would have helped us a lot, because as you were making the presentation, especially your introductory remarks, it was coming to my mind to say, when you say it's a human right, it actually means human rights can be current, but also they can be a post-factor matter. And I'm not sure sitting here whether I can say with qualification, I understand the report, what it was doing, but in the context of what Honorable Pignino was saying, a background projection. For instance, you've got things that you feel that when they happened in the past, they had human rights implications that were completely ignored. And in the current dispensation, how do you undo those injustices? I can make an example when we're sitting here, which is why I'm saying, if you go for an example in area, I'm saying specifically, I understand what you're dealing with now. If you go to areas like Mpumalanga, there's a place there called, what is it called? Ifanda, where you've got approximately 1,000 graves unaccounted for. And there seems to be no one who's saying, but how do you have 1,000 graves in a democratic dispensation, but no one can say, this person belongs to the Pignini family, and therefore this is what has to be done, even if it does not necessarily mean compensation and other things, but how do we, so I'm saying, maybe beyond what you have done, if time were noticed, you could have sat down and say, but beyond this, can you assist as we begin to take the other processes forward? I understand this one deals with the current situation, but there might be people who feel that some of the things that had happened, just for the sake of dignity, installing dignity, this is what we think it can happen. I'm sure, I hope you understand the context of what I'm saying. Because in my view, in the past, there have been many human rights violations that have taken place that have got an impact and effect in the current situation. Again, I'm not dragging you on certain things. Just some time we're listening here, and I now hear it even on the radio station. And I'm not sure whether your recommendations have to look on health, do not touch on those issues. The recent cases which they've been handled by, what do you call, I don't know how to say, those lawyers that were fighting for workers that would have incurred, or whatever you call it, suffered diseases based on what. So I'm saying, to echo what you say, it may not be easy for a legislature institution to take up some of these issues, except if it works with institutions like your Chapter 9 institution to say this is what has to be done. The last thing that I think we'll have to deal with, and in a cordial manner, not in what I said, because I said the biggest problem sometimes with Chapter 9 institution, as part or as they are second to the other arm of the state, which is the judiciary. That's what I would say. They are second to none except the other arm of the state, which is the judiciary, which can be the only one that can make a legal interpretation of what they would have suggested as an action going forward. even between the judiciary and the executive, there is a recognition and acceptance of the separation of powers, but there's something I'll call a tension. It depends how do they manage that separation of power, rather than to see it as a contestation, but see it as complementary. Equally, between the executive and the legislature, there will always be that tension. I call it territorial protection. People seek to protect their own territory. You can come, but on the terms that I understand, not on the terms that I understand. Now, my take is that the reason I'm saying we may not close as a committee, we'll have to go back and see in a serious way where there could be areas where there is a contestation. Let me make a simple example. If it's a recommendation or a finding, or let me draw two things. In the case of, is it Alex? She said that if you look on the recommendation on the, what do you call this thing, DMS? I'm a rural person sometimes, so I call it one-stop shop. You call it where you've got environmental license as well as water and so forth and mining rights. What do you one environment, yes. Now, it's put clear, it says, look, we made here a finding. We cannot make it a recommendation because it is a legislative responsibility. That's how the line function or the executive felt as a way of regulation it should go. But I'm making again, not in a bad way. There is somewhere where there are recommendations that says the department must look on legislative review. I'm not sure, I don't want to go on the slide on legislative review. Now, even before we say it's between you and the department, already between the committee and the department, there is a potential as to where that legislation gets generated. Then we say, look, legislation starts here, not in the executive. But the executive says, no. To do legislation, it's our duty. Chapter 9 institutions can only make a finding or a projection of what could be. You understand what I'm trying to say? So I'm saying maybe if we agree together with the department engaging, the committee will have to look and work with yourselves so that we don't start on the basis, because the problem is that people are very resistant to something that is an instrument. Power is not something that just easily donated. But I'm trying to manage that we should not have a debate that says, no. To do legislation, we can't be told by you. Just being honest and frank. Let's look at, is there a need to review the legislation? And if we review the legislation, this is what we suggest to be done. I think that, to me, becomes a harmonious relationship that begins to look at the issues rather than the powers. Where's got this power? Who doesn't have this power? The last thing is that whether we like it or not, we might have to look at not necessarily capacity, whether some of the recommendations really lies solemnly on the DMR or any other issue. Let me give you an example again. They can only operate on the basis of what the law currently says. Now, I hear you said it's not said. I can assure you, they may not say here. Some of these, they do have money. Going to court and tell you that we agree it may not be fair, that's a different story. It may not be fair, but tell me legally, which section are you using to say this is what you need to effect? That's why I'll be more interested on the time frame and so forth, because it might be good to get something that says, in terms of F. so-and-so, the Department of Mineral Resources, must begin to implement according to 1, 2, 3. Let's say if it's in terms of the MPRDA, in terms of the MPRDA section so and so, this is what we expect the department to have done and it has to do so. So that we understand even the procedure, if we were to change the procedure of licensing, what are those things? Because if you, if they enforce, they can do it. If they enforce, those who may can, who can afford, they just go to court and say, no, no, no. What you are demanding from me, it is not what it is required by law. I don't know whether that's my point. And if that is the case, it becomes a dispute between them and the mining company. And that determination is no longer based on a recommendation. It then becomes on the basis of a judgment. Now, a judgment, unintentionally or consequentially, overrules a recommendation made. So I'm saying those to me are some of the things, that's why I said I've not studied, are some of the things that we needed to see that as they continue to enforce, because we invite them here. When they come into the expenditure that every day they go to court, they lose cases, we then start to say, but why are you taking frivolous cases that they don't win? So that they don't hide and say, no, we have to do it because we got this recommendation. So my suggestion in essence for now is that your continuous engagement must be able to deal with some of the sticky points, so that whatever, because when they apply the law, surely on the other side there might be legal justification of doing the matter. The last thing, I think down the line we I'm more interested to get what could be our definition. There is a problem, or we call it a confusion sometimes. A general interpretation of the SLPs. Generally, others feel that SLPs are nothing else but what is supposed to be accrued even to workers. Now the question arises, what becomes the duty of trade unions? Don't you have something that is negotiated between? Because initially the housing scheme or housing project was on the basis that our legacy has been based on migrant labor system. And therefore that argument was more on converting your so-called hostels into family units. And then on the basis of that. But there's a general view that says, no, SLPs, I think the point that Alex was raising, SLPs must be looked broader beyond what is supposed to be accrued by employees. They must be looked on the basis of community development projects, that by virtue of the existence of a mining company, these are the proceeds that the community stands to benefit. So that we look at what becomes a right and what becomes a benefit or a legacy. That issue for me, it's gonna, so that you don't have, because somewhere there is something that says if the company does not comply it includes accommodation amongst other things. So I'm saying somebody comes and say, you cannot deny me a license because it is not necessarily a right. It is a benefit or a projection. So when the department, that's why I'm saying in terms of the rules, it might be nice to say in terms of section so and so of the Act, mining companies are supposed when it comes to SLP to have these specific issues of compliance and failure to comply with. This is what must be enforceable. So that my fear is that we may reduce an SLP as a projection and as a condition to a license to only accommodation. But if it is a commitment to build roads, to do this, to have vegetable gardens and so forth, my assumption would be that there should be a percentage attachment to say, in a failure of a mining company to comply, just make an example, with almost 70% or 80% of its SLP commitment, then the mining company must be able not to proceed giving the license, or must be able to withdraw the license. but there seems to be more emphasis on housing, and I fear that that direction it might go to what Honorable Schmidt was saying, where now housing moves away from municipalities as a primary responsibility and is being made as if it's for the mining. Although the mining charter they can talk, it begins to talk about an integrated system. But if you can clarify those things, and then I would give the MR to just make that commitment that has been made. Unfortunately, it has been preempted. I would have asked a question about you. Have you read this report and what you take? Okay, Babu Smajan.
I'll ask the
Thank you, Chairperson. I think everything that you've raised is very important. This is as much a process for the Commission as it is for the departments to whom recommendations are directed. This is one of the most far-reaching reports that we've ever published. We are doing new things in terms of monitoring the compliance with our recommendations. Under the new leadership of the commissioners, the new commissioners of the commission, there is a distinct intention to specifically act on our reports. We issued the first subpoena that we issued under their leadership in 7 years last year. The commission is trying to change its approach and, as Commissioner said, you know, really be a watchdog with teeth. So I think that there will be a lot of challenges for us that we will have to learn on the way, because it is also going to be an uphill battle for the commission as much as anyone else. And we also have our own capacity constraints, our own resource constraints. There is no civil society, like there is no sort of state organization, state-funded organization that is not currently affected by the budget cuts, etc. So we are in a soup with all the departments to whom recommendations are directed as well. With regard to those things, and a lot of the challenges that we'll face, you've anticipated some of them, we've anticipated some of them we have not anticipated, and we'll have to deal with them as we go. And you know, we've indicated to all the departments that we are sort of mandated to work with government to fulfill human rights. We want this to be an ongoing engagement in order and the only purpose that we have is to try and vindicate the human rights in the Constitution. That is our sole aim in doing this. That is the job that we are tasked with. So although we will be relentless in that, we wish to be incredibly pragmatic about it as well. So if there is something that we haven't anticipated, if there is a nuance that we haven't appreciated, then we have opened it to the departments to make us aware of those challenges, so that we can readjust and reposition ourselves when necessary. So I think that it's a learning curve for us as well, but we believe that we are pursuing and fulfilling our mandates as we were intended to do so in terms of the Constitution.
There's nothing more I want to add.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Member.
What's happening? Can you use this one?
No, thank you very much, Chair, and also Honourable Members and the Commissioner. The team from South African Human Rights Commission. We would like to welcome the presentation from the side of the department chair. I think I just want to reiterate on what the senior legal officer advisor of the commission alluded to earlier on in terms of our cooperation as the department in making sure that we assist the Commission in responding to some of the issues that they have raised. But then I think, Chair, it is equally important too that We are here as a team. I have a team of, you know, technical, say, experts or officials from the department, MPP, that is Mineral Policy and Promotion. We also have the Deputy Chief Inspector of Mines, and also the Deputy Director General responsible for Minerals Regulation. Now, there are specific issues that have been raised in the presentation that relate to these three branches. Now, it's not like we want to protect our turf as a department, but then I think it is important to note that some of the recommendations, they've got some serious implications on the department. Serious implications in the sense that the issue of compliance is very much important. Now, I think the commissioner raised a point earlier on that, and also the senior legal advisor, that we have to comply as a department. At the same time, they are also raising an issue of capacity, monitoring, and so forth by the department. We would like to welcome that part in particular of the capacity that, I mean, today we are having a budget presentation by the Minister of Finance. Hopefully, there will be some resources that have been made available, because we have presented to the honorable members about some of those constraints that we are having as a department. Now, Chair, I will give over to the officials maybe as I conclude. In terms of our commandy, Chair, I think we all know that around 2004 we came up with a piece of legislation that is more developmental in its nature and character, which is MPRDA, in trying to address the historical socio-economic inequalities, in particular looking at clause 9 of the Constitution. Now, based on that, Chair, we need to have a balanced approach in engaging on these matters. I'm raising this, not challenging the report, of course, I think we are in agreement, but we need to have a balanced approach in engaging on this matter. Now, the discussions that we have started with the Commission, even beyond this meeting, we still have those discussions. Now, the issue here is that, you know, if we have such recommendations, we have the Auditor General that would also come to the department and look at all the documents that have been received or adopted by the department. Now, we are also going to be judged on the basis of that, what did you do? Because some of the issues that are raised in the report, they are not within the purview of the department as such. I think this question was raised by the honorable members earlier on, that you have other departments, then we don't have any jurisdiction over those departments. Now, that also on its own poses a challenge to the Department of Mineral Resources. I'm raising it precisely because it will be a lost opportunity if we don't emphasize this point to the committee, because in no time we will be required to come back to the committee to account based on the presentation. We're just putting it forward that some of the things that are contained in the report, as a department, we are committed to attend to those issues. There are issues that we would not be in a position, because of different roles and responsibilities that are bestowed upon us as the Department of Mineral Resources. I must also be upfront to indicate that there are areas that have been mentioned. I think maybe on this point, we need to have really a serious conversation with the Commission, because on the issue of consultation, there is a provision where it says that in terms of the MPRDA, there is no provision for consultation. Now, if you look at MPRDA, you look at Section 10 in terms of where you need to consult with the affected and interested
the parties. You also look at Section 16, Section 22. There is a whole lot range of provisions that are making a provision for the consultation. Now, you remember that there is also Bengonyama judgment, where the judgment is very specific that there must be a meaningful consultation. And so, because I think the Chapter 9 and 10 institutions, as we're engaging, because we must also avoid conveying messages that are not consistent and coherent to the public, because ours should be, how can we then be able to help in making sure that we drive this country towards a direction in which you as public representatives, you will be more impressed with. Now, in conclusion, Chair, our mandate is to ensure that we inspire hope and confidence within the mining industry space. In so doing, we'll be able to attract more investors, both local and foreign, and we'll be able to contribute significantly to the GDP of our country and create more jobs. And that would help us in making sure that the high rate of unemployment is ultimately addressed. And so, Chair, in those few words, I would then start with the DDG MPP to reply specifically on aspects that pertain to policy, and Mr. Mbonambi will deal with issues that relate to mine health and safety, and the DDG MR will then conclude with those matters that relate to the mineral regulation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and colleagues from the Commission, and my colleagues from DMR. First, Chair, maybe by way of background, the Commission tabled this report to the IMC on distressed mining towns on the 22nd of August. Last year. When the report was presented on that day, we were informed that the report will be published the next day, on the 23rd of August. We had not seen the report, we had not read the report, we had not been given a chance to respond to the issues that are raised in the report. Ministers in that IMC meeting did raise this as a concern, but the response was, unfortunately, we cannot postpone publishing the report with that day. We then initiated a process where we engage with the Commission to sort of respond to the issues raised. As it has been indicated, there are timelines in the report. Some of the issues and recommendations we had to respond to within 3 months, some 6 months, and this is coming very soon. And most of the issues we've dealt with, some of the issues we've explained to say, for example, some of them have been overtaken by events, and we strongly feel that had we been given opportunity to see the report before it was published, we would have clarified those issues, and those issues would not be in the report today, would not have been in the final published report. I'm referring to issues such as where the report talks about the need to publish social and labor plans. That has been overtaken by events because that clause is there in the mining charter. We've made it a legal requirement on companies to publish social and labor plans in English and two other languages that are most spoken in that locality where the mine is. The second issue is on policy and legislation, which is a recommendation in the report. The definition of a community. This question was asked this morning, and the Commission could not respond to say what definition were they using. We've addressed that in the charter. We've defined the mining community. Again, it's an issue that's been overtaken by events. the consultation process again. We are saying, just like mining companies undertake a long consultation process when they are doing their basic assessment and EIA, we are saying they must follow the same process with the social and labor plan in consulting with the communities. We've addressed that already. We've even gone further to give meaning to Section 54 of the NPRCA, which is also a consultative process, which talks to a community or an affected and interested and affected party seeking to reach some form of agreement with a right holder in terms of resettlement or relocation. We are busy developing those guidelines and we are ready to publish for the document for comments. On issues relating to NPRCA amendments, Chair, we've responded to the committee to say, to the commission to say, I mean, it's understandable that amending legislation is not a decision we can take in the 3 month timeline that we've been given or the 6 month timeline. Amending legislation is not like in our hands, like Chair has indicated earlier on, and it's not something that can happen tomorrow. But we've also raised an issue to say, I don't want to say a concern, an issue to say, does amending legislation address every other issue? Like, are we saying every time someone is unhappy with something, then we say, yes, amend legislation? You know, otherwise we would be amending legislation every day like we change our socks. And is that tenable? Is that sustainable? So we say, as opposed to putting recommendations like amend legislation, do this, shouldn't we maybe say, how do we better improve implementation on this? So those are the issues around legislation and policy that we've put forward to the Commission in response to the report. There's also issues around mining in sensitive marine areas. And we said, DIA is there, DIA does that. Ourselves, DIA, DWS, Petroleum Agency South Africa, and a whole host of other institutions are part of a forum which talks and engages with the seabed authority, precisely because we are determined on protecting our territorial waters. Again, we believe, had we been given a chance to respond before the report was published, that would not have been in the report because it is taken care of. DIA is a lead department. We are there supporting DIA. They are developing guidelines. There are guidelines in place. There's legislation in place, but they are continuously updating the guidelines. Also based on, in fact, in the next month or so, I think we've got a study tour some of the countries overseas, just for us to benchmark to see how are other countries doing in terms of protecting their marine environment. That's how committed we are, and that's how much work we are doing in that regard. So coming to the housing and living conditions standards, and the whole housing issue being central sort of in the report, I need to start saying, maybe by saying that I think for the benefit of this committee and colleagues from the Commission as well, we all need to be cognizant of the fact that housing and mining being spoken about in the same sentence is a function of a legacy we come from. A legacy where mines were remotely located and mining companies then provided accommodation, which is a phenomenon that's not common in other sectors. And it so happened that the accommodation they provided at the time was inhumane, where in a hostel you would find adults having to share common space like that. With the passing of the MPRCA in 2004, Section 101 then said, the minister must publish or develop housing and living conditions standards. And the intention with that was to improve on those inhumane conditions and ensure that we eradicate hostels and have dignified accommodation. But, Chair, I need to say this. The ideal for us is to eventually phase it out and have and not have a situation where mining and housing are always spoken about in one sentence, just like it is with any other economic sector. You can have Tata come set up a steel factory here tomorrow. There won't be any issue with housing. Why must it be the case with mining? So these are the issues that we are addressing going forward as we improve on policy, as we improve on legislation. And having said that, Chair, with the Tata review process last year, we also had to amend the housing and living conditions standards. And the amendment is moving towards that direction where we are talking about subsidized housing for employees, mine employees, as opposed to accommodation being offered by a mining company. So that we end up having sustainable communities where somebody owns a house. It's not a hostel or a flat that they live in while they are employed. It's something sustainable that they will live in. And we did this in consultation with the Department of Human Settlements, where they were guiding us in terms of the basic standards and sizes of the houses and the calculation and determination of the subsidies. So maybe in closing, Chair, let me just say that policy and legislative issues and reviews are complex issues. Maybe going forward, as we continue to engage with the Commission, our plea would be that we don't rush to make, we're not quick to make recommendations on legislative review, but we rather look at what it is that we can do to improve on the implementation and, of course, monitoring going forward. Thank you so much.
Honorable Chair and honorable members, good morning again. And as the department, we respectfully note the findings and the recommendations by the Commission on commissioning of a study to assess the impact of mining activities on communities' health. However, we want to report that a similar study has recently been done by the department and was finalized in 2017. And the study is titled Adverse Health Impacts Associated with Dust Emissions from Gold Mine Tailings. From that study, we have come up with an occupational lung disease policy, which is was developed through the Mine Health and Safety Company's Council and for the use by the mining companies. As the department, we are continuously monitoring the strict implementation of this policy by all the members that are affected. Also, this is done in line with the provision in the Mine Health and Safety Act, Section 8, that requires that every employer must prepare a document that establishes a policy concerning the protection of persons who are not employees, but who may be directly affected by the activities at the mine. Furthermore, we also want to indicate that as the department, we have commissioned furthermore, I also wanted to indicate that as a department, we continuously promote health issues during the annual events like the TB Day and HIV Days commemoration, where members of the communities where the events take place are assessed for health problems and are assisted by the Department of Health. The individuals who are found to have health problems are referred there and then to the primary health care clinics in the area for their assistance. On the issue regarding the blasting, we again note the directive of developing the blasting regulations from the commission's report. However, we respectfully want to reflect that the regulation referred to in the report was promulgated in 2006, and has since been amended twice in 2015 as well as in 2018 to address the impacts of plastics in the mining communities. The recent regulations that were promulgated in December 2018 indicate that no blasting operations are to be carried out within a horizontal distance of 500 meters of any public building, public thoroughfare, railway line, power lines, or any place where people congregate, or any structure which it may be necessary to be protected in order to prevent any significant risk, unless a risk assessment has been identified, has identified a lesser safe distance and any restrictions and conditions to be complied with. Also, a written application needs to be submitted to the principal inspector of mines in the respective region, accompanied by the following documents for approval: a sketch plan indicating the distance from the blasting area to the affected structures, as well as the risk assessment, which is detailed. I think it is also important to mention that with those regulations, we have also commissioned a study with all the challenges that we have been receiving regarding the blasting related issues in the nearby mines. The study was concluded in 2017. And that study is titled The Development of South African Minimum Standards on Ground Vibration, Noise, Air Blast, and Flood Rocks Near Surface Structures to be Protected. From this study, which has been completed, we are currently busy now developing the regulations, and we hope that with the recommendations that have been made by the Commission, we'll have an opportunity to incorporate some of the issues that were highlighted in the report to improve issues of addressing blasting-related matters in the host mining communities. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members, colleagues, members of the Commission. We have noted and welcome the report and the presentation today. Here we have some few observations from our side as well. In terms of the IDP and the SLP alignment, we've always been saying at DMR that when mining companies draft or consult on the SLP, they need to make sure that they are aligned to the IDP. And the reason why we said that was because we assumed that the IDPs are documents that are consulted through the communities by the local government, which is the municipality in this case. So that collaboration is there between the IDPs and the SLP. I just thought I should note that. And as well, my colleague mentioned that most of the recommendations or the findings are already in place. For instance, if you look at the issue of the financial provision for environmental remediation, that is already there. We've got a trust fund, we've got the cash that is deposited into the departmental bank account, and we've got bank guarantees that are submitted by mines, except those legacy mines where, remember before 2004 when we started the NTRDA, there was no law that said to the mining companies, they must provide financial provision. You remember the Mining Rights Act of 1967, it was quiet. The Minerals Act of 1991, it was quiet. It's only after the NPRCA where we insisted and even put it on legislation that they need to provide for environmental remediation. So in terms of from 2004 onwards, we have insisted on financial provision for environmental remediation. And already, Shepherdson, discussions are undergoing on ring-fencing the SRP funding. That is some of the issues that we already attended to even before the report was produced or published. And also collaboration with other departments for us is very key. And those engagements are ongoing, especially between DMR, DEA, and DWS. We form a committee where we are collaborating not only on the because of the commission. We've been collaborating since, especially on the one environmental system. We also agree with the commission chairperson that we'll continue our engagement on the report as the solutions for us are not a one-size-fits-all, because it's not going to be possible to expect us to have those solutions by 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months. And also on the one environmental system, we agreed backwards in 2007 already that DMR will be a competent authority on mining-related issues and there to be an acting authority. And there was a reason why that was done. Solely based on both our constitutional mandate of each department. And then we also agree that the timelines might not be favorable for us as the DMR, because we also don't want to turn this recommendation or findings as just a tick box exercise. We agree with the commission that some of the recommendation or findings, they need time for the DMR to work on that. And we also agree that our detailed response will also follow in writing. In closing, Chair, we're hoping that the commission will also assist us to get additional funding so that we augment for our capacity, especially on the SLP. Thank you, Chair.
You see, Babu Suraja, then you agree with me. I'm very scientific, not a fango. DMR, I'm not giving you a pity. I'm assisting you. When you receive a report, there's a report here. I hear what your consent was, but there's a report here. As I was sitting here, I was just thinking, hey, I don't want to delay the meeting anymore, but how are you meeting? Because there's a report here. Can I make a summary? There's a report here. Bear with me, Honorable Member. DMR, can you respond to this report? Officially, send it to the commission. In the report, tell them what you have done as per the report of the things that they say here, what you intend to do with some of the things that are here, what are the limitations on some of the things that they are raising. If, for an example, is a legislative limitation, you then tell them here. And then let me be upfront, what are your reservations on some of the recommendations they've made here? I can tell you now, I sense from a distance, you'll end up at a time where they say the deadline has arrived, we have recommended you to do so, and you'll end up in court arguing about your non-implementation of the recommendations of a Chapter 9 institution. That's the tension I was talking about. So I don't want us to go back to that. That responds to the commission. If you need clarity on the final things that you can work with, do so. Let me come back to here now. Thank you, DMR. Now, we have got a high-level panel report. and we've got the Human Rights Commission report. Can you please go back, deal with the commonalities or similarities that exist between the two reports? Secondly, give us an account of what you have done and what you intend doing. And then give us an account of the limitations of what is contained in the report. Why it can happen and why it can happen. Now they will know that all of us sitting here, you can't ask the human rights. In fact, they will not. They will never complain if 1% of the budget that was meant to come to you is taken to them. They will not say, no, please do them a favor, give it to them because we want them to implement our recommendations. No, it's not going to. Everyone there is looking for money, including Parliament itself is looking for money. So that one who motivates, who, I can guarantee you, they have motivated for themselves too. So when you come back, just give us those details. Tell us where there are limitations in terms of legislative arrangement. Lastly, it may not be you, but Sibanyon. I don't know, I don't want to enter this thing, but I fear where we drive all along and only to, it's like in Kwakwasa, as a goal. You miss one off ramp in Joburg, then it will take you a long time to get the next one. So we don't want to make a U-turn when we are already there. Maybe in your report, tell us how much are your political heads involved in this process? Because some of the things, in my view, they may not necessarily be like your line function daily activity. They may require to, I hear you say there was an IMC, but I'm not sure how frequent and how much that process is being handled and managed. So that tomorrow we don't come here and find that we are caught in between the Human Rights Commission and the Department of Mineral Resources and the Minister. I'm not sure it will happen, but just to avoid it, try and make it more of a high-level activity, because it's a serious matter, the issue of mining. My only issue, DG, before the Human Rights Commission can, at some point, no. Everything, they are equal. Let me protect you, DG. Maybe we are emphasizing another issue that is silent here. In as much as we want to grow the economy, in as much as we want to make a better contribution in the country's GDP, we equally want to make it a point that it is done in a manner that keeps the dignity of our ordinary people that have been historically a subject of super exploitation and neglect. So in as much as we want this, it must be understood that unfortunately for you in particular, we have to strike that balance regardless of the circumstances. Is that not enough, honorable members? Then maybe we will jump just this week, I will speak to Ayanda, and then come back to us and also help us to prove that we have sent your response to the Human Rights Commission in writing. If you have done so, just get out of this meeting, email it, so that we can understand this engagement. An anonymous accountant would have said, keep quiet. It's not that they said they are engaging with yourself. So I needed to verify what they were saying, that they are engaging with yourself. And I don't think it's a difficult thing. The problem, from a committee point of view, I think it would be unfair to just accept. Maybe you just call each other. Can you have a meeting? And the other one agrees, let's have a meeting. We will talk about the reports and so forth. But we now request, can we get it formal? So that if you meet with them and you are unable to meet the deadlines they've given you, engage with them. I don't think there will be that much to say, okay, no, we see what you are recommending. But here is the limitation if we do so in terms of the timeline. Alex Babusmanyoni made a commitment that you are present to say you will forward us the, what do you call it?
The disaggregated recommendation.
Exactly, including the time, that has got the timeline. Please do so, because we can only enforce it if we get, we've got something on our head. Before I close, the honorable members, any closing remarks, commission?
Very briefly, Sean. Mandi I heard you saying on the 20th March you'll be saying goodbye and the like. We have got a request as the South African Human Rights Commission. Very important that your portfolio committee should include the engagement with the Human Rights Commission in your handover report to the 6th Parliament. But Shalo, I have this belief that maybe beyond May, maybe I will still be meeting some members of this committee. And then also, Shepherdson, you commented it very well, because when the DMR was speaking, I was whispering, I think, is this the same DMR that we met with on two occasions? Because it was amicable and all along. But I don't want to ruffle feathers with them. I want that negotiation, that mediation process, that engagement. Because even initially when we came in, we will open engagement, we will take that process forward. And then we are open for discussion, and that's the commitment that I'm making on behalf of the Human Rights Commission and the team here today, our crew here today. I don't know whether I'm leaving any important thing out, but
I want to mention one thing.
Yes.
Thank you so much. So yes, we won't respond now to DMI's little points that they've raised. We've noted them. There is just one correction I would like to make. One, the presentation you made today is not the report. It's merely an extract of the report designed for the Portfolio Commission. The report is much fuller, has much more context, has much more details, and does a lot more of what has been alluded to today. One thing that I do want to address, though, because I'm sure it's on the record or in the minutes, is that we did actually circulate a provisional version of this report to all the hearing participants, including DMR, on the 6th of December 2017. So there was a provisional report circulated. There was input received. I'm not sure if exactly by DMR, but I will check the records of the commission. I have access to the Dropbox, which is why I found this document that demonstrates this. So our investigative process is that a provisional report is circulated to all participating stakeholders in a national investigation, and comments are requested and received and then incorporated into the final report.
Also, it is very important, apart from the DMR, the department, the Human Rights Commission, our chairperson, Advocate Bongani Majola, has written a letter to the Minister of DMR and invited the minister for talks.
A cup of tea. Yes. Okay. No, there is nothing to do with that. When you meet, I know, that's why I said, for now, this is a report to us, as much as a presentation, but it's not the Human Rights Commission report, it's a report to the committee. They will respond, you left that meeting, and I'm sure when the chair of the commission and the minister meet, it's going to be a nice cup of tea meeting. Honorable members, do you agree that the department must come back and with more details, but combining, I must say, some of the issues raised here, they're a little bit similar to the high-level panel that was appointed by the speaker, that then it can only be them that can do so. But rest assured, the reason we invited you, let alone coincidentally on this day, but the reason we invited you is that it's some of the things that we have to finalize them so that even if they go to the Sixth Parliament, there is a clear procedure or process that was followed. Otherwise, they risk that if the Sixth Parliament comes in, they will just disappear. So that's a special. Honorable members, having said so, Can we go to the minutes? They are not long. You agree? Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. You don't even show them in the page. No. The reason I didn't ask him, somebody will tell us already right in a minute. I don't have to read it.
Yeah.
Page 4. Page 5. I must check whether I was sleeping. Honorable members, any move off the minutes? If I can let me socialize again, I'll wait for you until you do so, otherwise I'm not leaving here when they are in the house and no one wants to move the minutes. Any move off the minutes? Honorable Smith?
On behalf of my colleague here on the list, I move the minutes.
Honorable Smith has moved. Honorable Mafon?
The Chairperson, I don't know if I second Honorable Smith or his colleague, but there's a point.
No, we second the one who spoke. Okay. Honorable members, then with the minutes adopted, let me make things as easy for your matters arising.
No, there's nothing much than the letter.
There's nothing much than the letter. If honorable members, we will circulate the letter, but not in my view, so that we can speed up the process. The department has sent the response on the letter in writing, and can I suggest to the meeting that in the meantime, as a committee, we forward, we then write to the speaker to say, having received the letter, the matter was referred to the department, and what do you call here in or here under? Find the correspondence from the department as a response to the committee. But honorable, and then the committee in the meantime is also finding whether are there any other alternative ways of dealing with the issue. But we give. I'm doing this because, like I said, even when you look at this, it's going to be very difficult for a committee to undertake that matter. And then if honorable members, and I want this to be recorded, if honorable members, having a sight of that letter from the department, feel that there is an issue that requires the attention of the committee to deal with, then please, feel free, even if it's before the committee meeting, to say, no, we want to engage with the content of the letter from the department. Is that correct? Because there is a formal response from the department. If members feel, I'm trying to avoid that we deal with it now, but if members feel that we must deal with those contents, it will be allowed when we deal with matters arising in the next meeting. Is that agreed? Okay, you are released.